Okay, I want to start out. I'm going to cover cover cropping today, and I'm going to start out with, that's going to be second, but I'm going to start out with layout. If you're thinking about just starting a garden, or you've had problems with the garden you currently have, this is good for guys with 3 acres or less land. Okay, and all I've done is take what people were doing who are making a living small farming, organic farmers, charging 2 or 3 times more than Kroger. I have a little rebuttal for that, because I know, yes, we try to price our stuff at a local farmers market with local small farmers, and some of us are certified organic, which cost about $1,000 a year to be certified. Plus, you got to jump through a lot of hoops during your inspection, which costs money. Some of us grow that way. We can't advertise ourselves as organic, but we can say we grow that way. We're not certified organic, but we do grow by those principles. And if you're like me, I do use a few synthetic fertilizers that don't negatively affect the soil biology, but they help my mineral balance in my soil. Case in point, ammonium sulfate. So I can't really call myself organic or that I follow totally organic principles because I do use ammonium sulfate, which is not an organic fertilizer. But I don't use pesticides or herbicides or none of those chemicals, and I don't use any harsh, soluble synthetic fertilizers. But I'm going to tell you, the guys, at least, and I know this from experience, I'm not talking off the cuff, the guys I farm with that have 5-10 acres or less, and they're at farmers markets selling their produce organically 2 or 3 times what they charge at Kroger, they are not laughing all the way to the bank. They're barely making it. Usually, most of them have to be married to a wife who has a real job, so they can have some benefits. At least the guys, and I can't speak for corporate organic farmer, the corporate organic farmers, maybe their profit margins are a lot bigger, and they're charging more than they profit margin should have. But, those big organic farms, I'm all for them being organic because there's a time, I don't have it on here, I meant to put it on, but I got a slide, a Time magazine cover came out that said the real cost of cheap food. Okay, there's a lot of costs with cheap food. I mean, the only reason you can buy a Happy Meal at McDonald's for 99 cents is because most of that is subsidized by your tax dollars. Okay, they subsidize the corn growers, and that subsidy gets worked into the food system, so you only get charged 99 cents for a Happy Meal that's bad for you. Okay, we're Adventists, we don't eat Happy Meals, I understand that. But a lot of our processed foods are cheap because the corn and the corn syrups and all that kind of stuff are subsidized, and a lot of that stuff, a lot of those grain crops are all subsidized, and most of our processed foods are made out of grain, some starch derived from grain. So that subsidy works, makes food artificially cheap, and small organic farmers don't have those kind of subsidies. Okay, I don't know. None of my friends are. They don't drive expensive cars. They don't live in big houses because organic food's marked up 2 or 3 times more than conventional. I know a lot of doctors that drive expensive cars and have big houses, but none of my friends have big cars and expensive houses. And you got to also think about, even if you buy something from a big corporate organic farm, at least they're growing in a way that respects the earth, and that's worth something. I mean, if you're just looking at cheap food now for yourself, that's a little selfish. What about your kids? Because everything they pour onto the soil is going into the food supply, is taking that fertile soil now and making it depleted and lifeless. So it's just making that cropland get less and less and less. So your children and grandchildren are going to have, you're going to have more and more people on the planet and less farmable land. Even if I have to buy from a big organic concern, and even if they're making a lot of money, I'd rather think about my children and grandchildren not having a polluted world to live in. Where I'm concerned about is, geez, I can get this carrot at Kroger for this, and I got to pay an organic farmer 2 or 3 times more. So be it, 2 or 3 times more. It's the planet's worth it. Your what do they call that? Your legacy. I mean, 3 generations from now, what are they going to be looking back at us and say, geez, why didn't those guys respect the farmland a little better? All they were interested was, money, their own personal bank accounts. I'll compare bank accounts with any doctor any day of the week, and I'm sure he's going to beat me 9 ways to Sunday. So I want to get that down. The other thing mentioned is labels. Read the labels. Yes, we have to read the labels. I agree. But what are they not telling you on the labels? And they're not telling you what's GMO. They're not legally required to tell that on the labels, because you got to realize most of this is we're getting fed by corporate farms, and corporate farms they only have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. They don't have a fiduciary responsibility to their customer. Okay. Genetically modified organisms. Okay, there's gene splicing. GMO means they're gene splicing, you know, flounder DNA into a tomato. Okay, so you're eating some synthetic proteins that your body has never evolutionarily seen before, and they don't know how. I mean, the people doing it and making all the money are saying it's safe, but they don't know. And they're not coming forward with any of their test data. You know, they're just saying, yeah, we tested it, and it's okay. But they're not giving us the data. So what's the label not telling you? The label's not telling you that this carrot over here has got 2 times more calcium than this carrot over here. You know, they don't have to put that on the label. So there's things that the label's not telling you, and our responsibility is to either buy from people that you know, bricks out their produce, or tell our state representatives that we want this labeled this way. You know, we have that power. Also, you know, we saw in the cholesterol thing that too much of a good thing is bad. Same thing in farming. A lot of people think organic farming is all about compost and manure. Compost and manure are good things if you need compost and manure and the things they provide. But if you don't need compost and manure, if you've already got too much carbon in your soil or you've got too much potassium, which compost and manure will raise your potassium, then that's too much of a good thing, and you need to stop putting on compost and manure. Now, and soy. As Adventists, we eat a lot of soil traditionally. From what I read, and I have no reason to doubt it, you know, 90% of the American soy crop is GMO. It's got talk about organic. It's got to specifically say organic on it for it not to be GMO. Okay? So if you eat, I mean, the big three crops are canola, you know, rapeseed, GMO, that's 90% GMO, corn, 90% GMO, soy, 90% GMO, and cotton. You say, well, I don't eat cotton. Well, you eat cottonseed oils and just about everything. That's GMO, 90% of the crop. So if it doesn't say organic, it, as of right now, I mean, these big corporations are trying to get organic to include GMO. They haven't yet, but, you know, that may change someday. But right now, organic means no GMO. Yeah. Anybody had a question? Yeah.
What if it says no GMO?
Well, then it's no GMO. You have to believe that. I mean, yeah. Huh? Okay, the question was, what if it says non-GMO and not organic? Well, if it says non-GMO, then there's no GMO in it. You have to believe that anyway.
Also, they got a spray that even after they plant the soybeans, after they get up so high, they spray them to get them a 20% bigger because the farmers sell them by the bushel. So that's something else. You got the spray after. You got the GMO, the bean, which you said, you know, and then you got the spray. Also,
it's a GMO spray.
Yeah. Well, it's not. It just makes the bean larger.
Well, that might be okay. I mean, that might be just a fertilizer. I don't know. I spray foliar fertilizers on, but they're like fish emulsions and things that are natural. And so I'm into foliars, and I hopefully I can cover that. When we say GMO, that is something that is, you know, spliced into the gene, and it's usually spliced in the gene with a virus. Viruses go into the nucleus of cells, and they go into cells. That's why they're so hard to get rid of, because they're not in the bloodstream where your normal defenses are. And they're actually got these trained viruses that can go in and take a flounder, you know, piece of a DNA ladder from a flounder and attack a tomato DNA and insert the flounder DNA. So they use viruses to make GMO seeds. So you got that to worry about too, viruses. But anyway, so organic's not bad, and even though it's 2 or 3 times more expensive, that's not bad either. I hope, because when I had the church farm, I ran into this. Among Adventists, there's this big conspiracy theory, you know, with organic produce. You know, we've been buying produce for so long, and we never had to worry about it, so tradition says we don't have to worry about it now, you know. But I hope that it's not... Like I said, I don't know any rich organic farmers. I hope it's not just a meagerness on our part to want our fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables cheap, because there is a cost to cheap food. Let's do our investigation before we demonize something, you know. All right. We're going to talk about... Let's start off with some scripture before we get into the tough stuff. Proverbs 24:27 says, "Prepare your work without and make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterwards build your house." Here is breaking ground on a new Adventist church, and we build lots of houses of worship, but no fields are attached to feed that house. Okay, we live in a society and a culture that likes to build, and we like to build churches, and we, you know, pat ourselves on the back and say, success, 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 we've built all these churches. But according to Proverbs, every house of worship should have a field attached. And you should build, and you should be more concerned with that before your house. You know, I think that would really bode well for the community. You know, we talk about community, we talk about relationships. Clean agriculture, and I'll just call it clean agriculture rather than organic. Clean agriculture attracts people. Clean agriculture builds relationships. And I'm not talking just among Adventists, I'm talking people outside Adventism, and you get to intermingle that way. And we need to, you know, we need that attraction. So, anyways, and if the purpose of the church, or one of the purposes of the church, is to, you know, prepare people for heaven, I would think that would fall into a definition of a purpose of the church. What is heaven going to be like? Well, this doesn't get covered too much, but, you know, if we started out, God planted a garden. Before sin, even before sin, we were to work the garden. And God, He could have spoke a garden into existence, but He came down and planted one Himself. It seems like He enjoys that, you know. And so he planted a garden in Eden, and it says right here, and this is a verse that's commonly referred, you know, says, interpreted as being referred to the new earth. "For behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth," right there, "and the former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind, and they shall build houses and inhabit them." So there's nothing wrong with building houses. It's just, do you attach a field to it? "And they shall plant vineyards." There you go. We're going to be planting vineyards in heaven. "And they shall eat the fruit of them. And they shall not build another and another inhabit, and they shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of the tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands." This is going to be heaven. It's not going to be just strumming harps or eating cotton candy or floating around on clouds. I mean, it's going to, you know, or walking around the streets of gold saying, "Man." I mean, it would get pretty old quick if we're up there going, "Man, isn't this wonderful?" I mean, we're going to be working. We're going to be the work of our hands. We're going to be doing stuff. So let's prepare for it now. And let's have the church involved in that gardening and preparing for it. Okay, into the layout. Now, Elliot Coleman, who's written a few books out there, I don't have them in there, but they're good books, called New Organic Grower was his first book. There he is up in Maine. He kind of was the guy who said, geez, why can't small farming pay for itself? Why can't I make a living small farming? And so he kind of went the, you know, he's sort of a counter-culture figure, because most people are saying, get big or get out. And he was saying, I want a small farmer to make a living, and he did. He's up in Maine, and he's quoted as saying, I've read one of his quotes that says, he got kind of a hassle because he said, you know, it's no problem making $100,000 on an acre of land. Gross. I'm not talking net. I'm talking gross, before expenses. And they said, well, yeah, but you're teaching all this season extension stuff where you can charge more money because you have hoop houses and you're growing a little outside of season, so you're the only guy at market with tomatoes and nobody else has them, so you can charge more. So he recanted and he said, okay, with an acre of land, anybody should be able to make $80,000, even in selling in-season produce. And I'm telling you, I've seen it done. It can be done. It's not a false statement. Okay, you can make gross $80,000 on an acre of land. You're going to have expenses, and you're not going to be able to bank all that $80,000. You might be able to keep half of it. $40,000 is not laughing all the way to the bank. And yes, you are charging two or three times more, but you're not, $40,000, you're not laughing all the way to the bank. You're driving old cars, and you're living in humble housing. Okay, 5 acres. He says 5 acres is the optimum size because it's about as much land as a couple or a small family can manage. Okay, that's 5 acres. Then he says, to effectively manage a farm operation, I believe there is a person-land ratio that cannot be exceeded. later on he says, I place that upper limit at somewhere around 2.5 acres per person. So he's saying that if I want to do a farm, I can manage by myself without any hiring outside help 2.5 acres. That's the upper limit. I've been on a 1.5 acre farm, and that's a job for one person. I think I could handle 1 acre by myself. After 1 acre, I'm probably going to have to start hiring some part-time help, or maybe a family member, because we're all, you know. So, but Elliot Coleman has been doing it, so maybe you can beat my 1 acre and move more towards his 2.5 acre per person. But I'm happy with 1 acre and $80,000, keeping maybe $40,000 of it. Okay, this is what all the farmers I know that do this for a living, they don't use mulch like the guy on Back to Eden. They do beds, and these are unstructured raised beds. Their beds are naturally raised because you're never walking on them. Okay, that's this type of farming. You're always, and they have, this is perfect, they have the grassed walkway that's wide enough to mow. And that's what I promote. These. And so the only thing you're tilling is this bed right here, this 4 foot wide bed. That's the only thing you're tilling. You're just mowing this. You're leaving it alone. It's a lot easier. If you sat there and tilled the whole square or the whole rectangle and then had to try and reform beds and then weed the walkways, you cut down on your weeding by 35% if you have permanent walkways. It's a lot easier to mow a grass walkway than it is to weed one. Okay? So if you've already made your big rectangular square, plant some fescue grass in the walkways and start growing grass in your walkways and don't ever till them up again. Now, tractor farmers can't do this. Only tiller farmers can do this. And sometimes you might have to have that big tiller, that BCS tiller. Everybody know what a BCS tiller is? A Grillo? They're like huge. They're actually two-wheel tractors. They can have any implement on the front of them. And they have a big rototiller, and you might have to go to that if you're doing like 3 acres to a quarter acre. But anything less than a quarter acre, you can just go to Sears and get a $800 tiller and do really well. I don't know about Mantis. They're kind of like a little, they're not quite up there. But a nice Craftsman, the sort of the top-of-the-line Craftsman tiller, does a fine job for a quarter acre or less. But anyways... Or, if for some reason you can't do grass, at least mulch your walkways like this guy did. He's got garlic and onions. I think on the right side is onions, and the left side's garlic. And he's mulched his walkways. He's not growing grass. It looks like he's got wheat straw. We tried leaves because leaves are free, and you have to buy wheat straw from the store. But leaves sometimes bring in a lot of... We've had disease problems when we brought in leaves. Yeah. Wheat straw is kind of, when you till it, you can till wheat straw in, and it doesn't really jack up your potassium like leaves can. What?
You're right. And it's there for a long time, too.
Yeah, you can till wheat straw in. It doesn't have a lot of residual nutrients in it that you might have too much of already. I mean, in my case, I had put a lot of organic fertilizers and a lot of manures. Not organic fertilizers, a lot of compost and a lot of manures on, thinking you can't get too much of a good thing. And I had jacked up my potassium levels, and I had to come in and not put on any organic matter for 5 years to get my potassium levels down. And so I kept asking them, can I till in wheat straw? I kept asking my soil testing lab. And they said wheat straw is okay to till in because there's really not a lot. It doesn't really affect the potassium levels. But, leaves and stuff like that can really jack up your potassium levels. It's okay if you need potassium, but if you don't need potassium, it's not okay. Okay, you got to avoid it. Because in balance, in this sort of alternative soil testing, too much of something is worse than not enough of something. I'd rather have not enough of something and work my way up gradually through soil tests than, once it's in the soil, it's hard to get it out, So, and when you go down to the county extension agent to get your soil test, and they send it to the university, in their world, in their paradigm, there is no such thing as too much. There's only not enough. So they don't really care if you've got too much of something. To them, that's not bad. And from where I come from, too much is worse than not enough. The question was, what lab do I use? I use a lab because I questioned about four different labs that had four different philosophies that weren't conventional philosophies. They were four different independent labs, and I chose International Ag Labs. They run off a Kerry Reams model of soil health. Anybody know who Kerry Reams is? He was an Adventist way back. He got kind of kicked out. It's a sordid story, but he was a very smart guy, and he had a certain philosophy about bricks and nutrient density. And see, being an Adventist, I kind of come at it like, I want total health plants. I'm really not concerned with calling myself organic. I want a full nutrient component in the food I'm eating. And that's where Kerry Reams was coming from. And this soil lab I use, that's where they come from. And there's another guy that I've heard good things about, and people that use him like him. His name is Neil Kinsey. He's in Missouri. And he does the Albrecht model. William Albrecht was a guy who had his own philosophy, similar to Reams, but there's some differences. And you'd have to read them. I don't have enough time to cover both philosophies. I can give you the finer points after the discussion, or some of the base points after discussion, after the talk here. But Albrecht, he was all about the CEC, cation exchange ratio. Did Bob Gregory talk about that? Cation exchange ratio? Anyways, he was all into that, and that's one philosophy. And the people who use that, they have good crops, low bugs, low weeds, and good crops. And then you have the other lady that I like is Elaine Ingham. Now, she's still living. Reams is dead. Albrecht's dead. They have their disciples, but they're dead. But Elaine Ingham was a microbiologist in Oregon, and she wrote that book, Teeming with Microbes, that got sold out. But if you get with them, they can reorder it for you. He wrote that book according to Elaine Ingham's philosophy, Teeming with Microbes. I don't use her, but she's the one who says if you get the biology right, it'll provide all the nutrients you need. It's already in the soil. So the funny thing with Elaine Ingham's soil lab, she's got Soil Food Web soil lab. I think it's called soilfoodweb.incorporated or whatever. She's a soil lab. She doesn't test for elements, off the period, like calcium, nitrogen, phosphorus, like the other two do. She just looks at the biology. She'll sit there and count fungi forms and bacteria forms, active bacteria versus dormant bacteria, and she'll let you know the health of your soil just biologically. And a lot of people like that, and I've seen people that have good results using her labs. So those are the three I would use. And then there's other labs, I can tell you, that try to combine all three, all three philosophies. But they're all different than what you're going to get from your county extension agent and your university labs. They use a test called the Mellick 3 test, which is, some people question the accuracy. It's really used because it can move a high volume of soil samples in a short amount of time. And they're always pushed for time because they get a lot of soil samples, so they got to do it quick. So that Mellick 3 test, some people have some problems with. All right, let's keep going about layout. Oh, I went the wrong way. All right. Okay, this is when I had the church farm last year. This is me with my Sears Craftsman rototiller, which is about $800. It's from Sears. And here you can see I have my walkways over here, and I have wooden stakes that mark off my bed. And right now I'm taking down a summer cover crop. I've mowed it. Here's a mowed summer cover crop. And here I've come down this line and tilled it in. You can see it takes me about two passes to do that 4-foot wide bed. And usually you get a blank spot in the middle because there's a transmission there in your tiller. So you get this little blank spot. I usually have to go over it five times. That's the least amount I go. I try to keep it as low as possible going over it. But because of the transmission blind spot in all rotary tillers, I kind of go down the middle first. This is before I did it this way. I go down the middle first, then I do the far edge left, far edge right, and then I kind of do halfway to the middle from the edges on both sides. So I usually, on a 4-foot wide bed, I try to just do four passes. And right now I'm tilling it in lightly, not deeply, because I've mowed this down. I had to cut it with a hedge shear first. I've mowed it down, and like I said, why do I want to till it in shallowly? Who was paying attention? Huh? No, well, yes, you don't want to destroy the microlite, but I was looking for something different. That's a good one, though. You're correct. Yeah, 3 inches. But the reason for 3 inches, it's because your microbe life can only break things down because your things that break stuff down good love oxygen. You know, if you got and the deeper you go, the less oxygen there is. So that's why you kind of want it, some of it sticking out. It looks a little trashy, but believe me, because you till it in shallowly, it'll break down faster. And you got to keep it wet. If it's like this was, you know, like a hot part of the summer, it's a summer cover crop. I'm getting ready to plant a fall bed there, and you know, occasionally I'd have to run through there, and I had to use. I tried to treat my water to take the chlorine out. I was on a municipal water supply, and you know, spraying chlorinated water when you're trying to promote biological life is kind of counter. You know, it's hard to do. So I tried to treat my water, but I had to keep it wet because biology needs wetness too. I mean, even though you till it in shallowly, if it hasn't rained in a couple of weeks and that soil's dry as dust, there's not going to be a lot of biological life there, even though there's a lot of oxygen. Okay. So you're going to have both. You've got to have a little wetness. You got food for them here, this green matter that you're lightly tilling in, and you need a little wetness too. They need a little water. Not too much water, not too little, just a little. So every now and then I'd have to go through there and spray some water on there to get it to break down. But here I'm just talking about the layout, and you can kind of get the layout. Over here is a 4 foot wide bed with pole beans on it. Over here is a 4 foot wide bed with eggplant and peppers on it. And I forget what this was going to be, but anyways, it's going to be a winter. These are summer crops. You know, I'm on rotation, so every year I'm going to rotate that down, okay? The pole beans are going to go here, whatever was here was going to go here, and everything's going to rotate down one. And you can see all my beds, this one over here is the same length and width as this one, okay? There was 10 of them. They're all the same length and width. Why is that? That's what my farming friends do that do it for a living. Because why it's good to do that is because when it goes to when I order my fertilizer, I calculate my square footage on each bed. I don't calculate the walkways, so you're cutting down on your fertilizer bill because you're not fertilizing the walkways, right? I calculate my square footage on add up all my fertilizer beds, and then when my fertilizer comes and I can't get this at Home Depot, I got to mail order it, so it comes, and I just split it up into 10 equal parts. I don't really need a scale and getting all that. I can just split it up into 10 equal parts. You can use a scale if you want. But see, everything's standardized. You know, if I planted, if it took me 2 pounds of pole beans to plant 100 bed feet of pole beans, well, guess what? Next year, and I had to figure that out. That takes time to figure that out. Well, next year, I said, well, I like those pole beans. I want to grow them again. I know exactly how many to order. I don't have to sit there and refigure. Okay, that makes your life a lot easier when you don't have to sit there and recalculate because this bed's different from this bed. I'm rotating in a smaller bed, and it's, you know, everything's a lot easier. When I go to water, I'm going to cover irrigation here coming up in a couple days. When I go to water, every bed gets the same amount of water. You don't want to overwater. You don't want to underwater. You know, you want a certain amount of water. So standardizing your beds, the same length and same width, is a critical part of this. So, and I have people that I consult with. They want to, you know, chop and change because, you know, they can fit something over here and fit this over here. And I said, I can't bless that because, you know, that kind of is a critical part of this whole thing is standardized beds so you can rotate easier, you can fertilize easier, you can irrigate easier and all that. Everybody, that makes sense to everybody? Okay. Well, you know, that's a simple thing, but most people haven't, you know, don't realize that. So if you're a small person, that was an eighth of an acre there. 10 100-foot, 4 foot wide beds. That was about, well, I was. That's about 3,000 and something growing area. But I also include the walkways in that. It was about 5,500 square feet. That was an eighth of an acre. And that's the farm I made the second year. I was able to make grow 17,000 on. Now this could be your backyard. Some of you guys said that you had a backyard. You just want to grow your own food for your table. You're not interested in going to market. That's great. Love that. Well, this is what you do. Same principle, just shrunk down into a smaller scale. You're leaving your grass walkways, your 4 foot wide beds, and you know, if you can only, I always like to grow 10 feet of something. I don't, you know, I mean, why bother if you can't grow 10 feet of something? I want something that, you know, I can at least get 4 or 5 meals out of, you know what I mean? Because that square foot gardening that I started off with, I mean, I had a little bit of this, a little bit of that. What are you going to do with four pole beans or, you know, four bush beans? I mean, it's hardly enough to do anything with. I mean, yeah, you're like, oh, well, there's one. I guess I can eat it raw, you know. But, you know, I want to fill my table. I want abundance. And you got to grow 10 feet of something to get any kind of abundance. So that's kind of on my minimum length is 10 foot of bed. Here's a guy. I just did his. He's over in Decatur, Georgia, urban backyard garden. And you can see we staked out a big rectangle, and then we had to measure his lawnmower, though. His lawnmower, usually I say 2 foot walkway, because most mowers can get down a 2 foot walkway, but, you know, now making them bigger now, I guess they look bigger. People think they're worth more or, you know, better because they're bigger, but I had to make his walkways 26 inches because his 22-inch deck lawnmower wasn't fitting down a 26-inch walkway. So always measure, if you're going to plan on push mowing your walkways, make sure you measure and make sure you can get your mower down it before you set this out. So we have 4 foot wide beds, and I like this picture because you can see right here, there's a nice edge to that bed, right? I wouldn't, now on the corners, there's a corner back here, there's a corner off up here, there's, maybe there's another corner, I think there's maybe another bed, well, I don't know. Maybe that's before I put it in. But there's a corner here, and there's four outside corners, okay? And I usually put a metal stake in the four outside corners because that's not going to change. Those are my landmarks. And I square the whole rectangle off and drive a metal stake down in deep. You can get them from Home Depot. They're about this long. They're surveyor stakes. They got a point on the end. Drive in really nice. And you just leave them there. Then I put wooden stakes in to mark my beds. And I like these wooden stakes. Then I string the bed so I can get a nice straight line there. But I like to leave these wooden stakes in. I'll take the string off after I've made the bed. But I like to leave these wooden stakes in because and have them slanted a little bit out. There's a little slant to it, so it slants out. Because when you're dragging the hose around, you're not rake. They kind of help it your hose not rake over your plants. Everybody's shaking their head like they've had that problem before. Yeah. Yeah, well, this helps out a lot if you do it that way. Yeah, and if you slant them a little out, now if you put the stakes in straight up, sometimes the hose will ride over it, especially if you're kind of close to it. But if you slant them, it kind of hooks it under there. Yeah.
God, my husband doesn't want me to do raised beds because he says that they dry out faster.
Yeah.
You said that all you're doing, you're not really raising the bed, you're just...
I'm just not walking on it.
Yeah, so it really isn't what they call a raised bed.
It is, because if you walk on this and you don't, you know, that's the whole reason of doing it this way, is you never walk on your beds. I mean, that's just a rule. Sometimes you have to do it when you're forking it, you know, you step on it occasionally. A lot of times I can till it. That tiller is really nice. I can do it with one hand. But sometimes if it's kind of rough and hard, I have to get in the bed with the tiller. But, you know, a couple passes is not going to kill you. I mean, just don't do it as a practice. Walk in your beds and try to stay out of the beds if at all possible. And it's going to naturally let the soil aerate and fluff up. And, you know, this is naturally going to push this down and flatten it and make it hard, you know. And see, I like to grow grass in here. And this guy doesn't have much grass, but come September when is the time to plant grass, I'm going to have him aerate this with an aerator. And we're going to plant fescue. Fescue is a good grass because it doesn't run. It stays where you put it. You don't want to plant Bermuda or any other of this running grass in there because it'll just run right into your beds and you'll have a hard time keeping it out. But fescue is a nice grass, stays put, and then you're walking on grass instead of mud when it rains or when it's wet. Okay? And I plant fescue all around the peripheral too. And it's nice to have. And up here, fescue grows good. We have a little harder time because it gets so hot down there. But fescue is a cool season. You know, it likes the cool weather. So fescue would be fine up here. Okay, well, I'm assuming you don't have horses, yeah. Okay. We'll plant something other. Plant any grass that doesn't run. Okay, that's what I'm mainly getting at. I just use fescue. Okay, what I wanted to point out here is, see that little knife edge there? I string a string from that stake to that stake, from there to there, and I go down and I take my spade fork. Everybody know what a spade fork is? It's a shovel. The square? No, it's not. A square shovel is something like you scoop off a pavement with. A spade fork is a garden, or a spade shovel is a garden shovel. It's kind of beefy, it's short handle, okay, and it's a beefy shovel. Some of them have a flat nose. Mine has a bit of a curve to it. I like it. and I actually grind a sharp edge on it so it knifes into the soil really well. And I come in here, and I go down just on the outside of that string, and I make a nice vertical edge right there, right down that string. And I just chunk about 6 inches deep. And I chunk everything up into there. And then I get all these chunks in here, and I got this nice vertical edge. And then I run over it with a tiller, lightly, and I crush up all those chunks. And then I come in with my broad fork, which is like a garden fork, but it's a bit wider, and I'll show you that later. And I come in and I crack open the bed with my broad fork. I just crack it open. And then I'll come in and I'll take a rake and I'll because I tilled it, I kind of mush dirt into that edge, into that ditch. And I'll come in, I'll reestablish that ditch with my rake. And I'll smooth it out nice and flat, and then I can plant in it. And I like to have that ditch because that's the beauty of these beds. Another benefit of these beds is because they have good drainage and they're a little higher than the walkways, if I have a heavy rain, the water doesn't flood my plants out. It collects right in that ditch away from my plants. I love that. If you have a bunch of pools of water right there in your bed, you're going to drown your roots. You're going to drown your biology, okay, in a heavy rain. So I like having that good drainage away from, you know, it keeps it dry, but not too dry. It dries out faster than that ditch does or any low areas, but you don't want water standing around your plants. I mean, that suffocates them. They drown just like people drown. Your microbes need air just like we need air, okay? So he's had torrential rains coming, and he said if it wasn't for those ditches there, those little edges that we try to keep maintained, it would have washed away his plants. But those ditches caught the rain and collected the rain away from the plants, but near enough to give it some moisture. So it's really a good little design. And it's doable on a small scale. Now, you know, you get up to a quarter acre, you might not be able to finesse it this much, but you can do as much as you can towards this, okay? This is a not so good. I mean, here is the typical way people do it. They come out here and they stake it off, boom, 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 and they till the whole thing up, you know, go this way, and then they go crossways, and they go diagonal, and they just... And I had the lady that took over from the guy I taught from that acre and a half farm, her name was Rachel, and we were good friends, and we interned together, and she got in there, and she was a little over her head. You know, it's one thing being an intern, it's another thing, it's your show, you know, the farm is your show. And she used to get in there, and she wrote in one of her newsletters to her customers about, well, I've just tilled the beds, and we got nice, fluffy beds. You know, I said, Rachel, you don't want fluffy beds. That's a nice dog's name, but you don't want fluffy beds. Because when you over-till the soil, and you do all that stuff and make it nice and fluffy, it's fluffy until the first rain. And then it's flat as a pancake and hard as a brick. Okay? It doesn't stay fluffy very long. So don't get fooled. You need soil structure. That means microbes give you soil structure. So just remember, over-tilling something is going to really destroy your microbes, and you're not going to have fluffy soil for very long if you over-till your soil or you deep-till it. You know, you just don't even think that. I mean, fluffy soil is not good. Okay? It goes hard with the first rain. And so this is what most people do. Don't do it. You can see he tried to form beds, but now he's going to have to weed these walkways. And the walkways are really too narrow. You know, you're probably going to have to tightrope down the walkway. You're not going to be able to get a mower down there, so you're going to have to weed them. It's going to be muddy. I mean, I'd rather have a 2-foot grass walkway, you know, and be able to mow it. And here's another one. You can see the weeds already, you know. Here he doesn't even have beds. He just sort of planted a line of this and a line of that and a line of this in his big square, big rectangle of, you know, parties tilled up. And you can see the weeds are about to take over and overrun him, or he's going to have to get down there on his hands and knees. He's got a big problem here. And this is when you get frustrated with it and you want to say, give it up and say, well, I can't do this. It's too much time. It's too much work. And you don't do it. The things I'm telling you, make it efficient, make it fast. If it's efficient and fast, you can spend an hour, 2 hours a day out there, maybe every day, every other day, and you can do it and get it done, and it'll be enjoyable, and you'll do it because it doesn't take all your time, and you see some success, and you're motivated by that success. If you don't have a poor layout, it leads to neglect, and this is, I mean, this is a picture I took, And I should have took a picture of this when the guy first started because I was there. This was over at Gaia Gardens, and this was part of their... They have little community plots for the people that live there in the townhomes. And that's what I like. It was a working garden, acre and a half, but then they had little community plots for people who wanted to do it themselves. And the farmer was right there, and they could kind of feed off the knowledge of the farmer, you know, but it was just a sort of hobby for them, whereas the big farm, it was his income, it was his bread and butter. And it works out really well that way, and I could see it working in a church that way. You know, the church could let the farmer do a working farm and let him make his income there, and then it could have a little space for and rent out community plots for people who just wanted to do it as a hobby. And they could, you know, you could feed each of all. And see, those people helped the big farmer out because when he had to go out of town or something, he could get one of these little community farmers, hey, could you come water the plants while I'm gone for 2 or 3 days? Yeah, sure, no problem. You know, so it was nice that way. So, but when this farm first started out, I mean, you can see the little boxes. You know, this is what most people think of as raised beds. You have to box it in with wood. Wood is a maintenance problem. And it wears out, and you're always having to replace it. And then it's hard to get a tiller up in there, you know. And then you got to fill it with gourmet dirt. And I call it gourmet dirt because you got to buy it from somewhere, and it takes a lot of dirt to fill it, even a small box, you know. I just think working with the soil that's in the ground is perfectly fine. But anyways, this looked real cute and nice 3 months ago. But then it got hot, and he had to go out of town for a week. And, you know, nature, weeds are always ready to take over, and you got to keep on top of them. And this is what it turned into. So this is just a poor design. He couldn't get a mower in here. His little spaces between boxes was too thin. Weeds are going to find a way to grow through mulch. They're going to find a way to grow through plastic. You're better off leaving yourself some space to mow them or deal with them somehow, okay? So, again, that about says it all. Poor layout leads to neglect because you get frustrated. When it gets like this, you get frustrated and you don't want to garden again. Yep.
My son tills for me right before a hard freeze in November. He tills deep to kill, like, larvae from insects and stuff. Is that still considered bad for the bioorganisms? Like, right before a freeze to kill some of the...
Yeah, it would be.
It would be
yeah,
bad.
Turning up the soil that deep. I mean, I can see his logic, but, you know, a lot of things you have to... What is my net gain? You know, am I taking two steps backward and one step forward, or am I taking one step backward and two steps forward, you know? If you're taking one step and two steps forward, it might be worth it. You know, that's something you'd have to kind of... I don't really have a hard freeze in my area, so I can't really speak from experience, but it might be something you want to maybe try it both ways and see, you know? And then I'll come to your talk, and you could tell me if it works, because it sounds like a good idea if it works. Okay, this is my home bed, and this is kind of earlier before I had a 2-foot walkway. These aren't 4-foot wide beds, you can see, but since this picture, I have got my beds to 4 feet wide, and I still haven't been able to maintain a 2-foot grass walkway here. So those are just my home beds. And you can see I got three, but up here in the corner I inherited a sort of, this was the square garden I sort of inherited, and I was just going to take it out and just have three beds. But things were growing in here, so I made an L-shaped bed, and there's a walkway right here in between the top of that straight bed and this L-shaped bed. And I have since lengthened that out, so now the total bed length is the same as these, and I've got standardization again. Now, I wouldn't, you know, if you've not started this, I mean, I just had to sort of do that. But there is standardization now that I lengthened it, and it is a 4-foot wide bed up here, and it matches these other three beds. I wouldn't do this if I was just starting out. I wouldn't plan it this way. But it just shows you that I, you know, really went after keeping the beds the same length. But, that's the ones. That's my small garden plot at home, and I just use the same principles I learned at the acre and a half farm. Now, that little extra extension, I did, I read so much wonderful things about double digging. I said, well, I'll just double dig that part. I didn't double dig those other beds, but I thought, well, I'll try double digging this. I don't know, I extended it out about 10 foot. Well, I will never do that again. That 10 foot of bed that was double dug was a killer. I think it took me like 3 days. And this is just to show you, I dig it, you know, this is how you double dig. You dig out this trench, you know, nice squared off trench. That's what a spade shovel is. There's a spade fork. Anybody didn't know what it was, that's it. This is an $80 spade shovel. You can get them for $20 at Ace. But I always tell people, get quality on this stuff so you can pass it down to your grandkids. Don't buy this cheap stuff from China. It breaks. I mean, it's easy. I even got a little crack in this thing, and this thing is the beefiest shovel I've ever seen. And I even got a little crack in that. I'm going to have to get a guy to weld it and sort of, because it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. But, you know, you put a lot into these. You know, you're trying to pry this clay out and see what you're supposed to. Double dig means you dig it once, the depth of the shovel, which is about, I guess that's about 10 inches. I guess, I'm not sure, I used to know, I forgot. You dig it once, 10 inches, and then you come in and you're supposed to spade, fork, the bottom of, you don't dig it out the second part, but you just aerate it down in there. And then you take this section of 10-inch dirt and put it over here and do the same thing to the bottom of that trench. That's double digging. Did everybody know that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I tell you, it was hard enough getting that 10 inches out. It was impossible to even, I had to get a pickaxe in there. I mean, like I'm like, you know, what are those, a miner or something in there trying to pickaxe through that solid clay. I thought, there's got to be easier ways. And there is easier ways. You don't have to double dig. And imagine if you had to do a whole, you know, quarter acre like that. I think that'd be the end of you. And here's what it looks like when it's all done. I put a little, you know, that's before I did soil tests, so I put some compost in there, and there it is all filled in again, that little extra extension. Oop. All right, here's the church farm, and that was my helper. And you can see we did an eighth of an acre, and we strung it out, made our beds. We had a metal post here, metal post way up here, metal post way up here. We got 10 of these beds. We strung it out. And here we're putting some, we got a dump truck full of zoo manure. It's exotic manure. They sell them about $400 a truckload. And we were, we knew the soil needed. We should have soil tested first, but it was in the spring, and I don't like the soil test till August. So we just put a little light application of this zoo manure. I wouldn't advise. I'd get a soil test first. I think we did it wrong here because you can mess yourself up putting manures on and you don't know what's in your soil. But we got it tested afterwards and it wasn't that bad. You know, we just needed some organic matter because it was just a hard as rock Bermuda grass covered plot. You know, it was, and so we just figured we needed something. And then we soil tested in August. And we weren't too bad. We didn't mess ourselves up too much.
God, how did you get rid of that Bermuda grass to start with?
Well, when I went away, and McDonald, that guy, he went down to Home Depot and he got about 8 Mexicans. Illegal. And I said, oh man, that's just such a bad testimony. You know, why, we should be able to do this ourselves. But they desodded it. He had about 8 guys out there, and they had wheelbarrows, and they were, you know, using square-nose shovels to kind of slice under the Bermuda. And I'm telling you, we didn't get rid of the Bermuda. I mean, the Bermuda is still there because Bermuda goes like 6 feet deep. But we did, like, you know, you just can't till Bermuda under or any of that type of running grass. You've got to kind of at least try to get at least the top part out of there. Yeah, like I said, we tried to come under it just slightly, not deeply, okay? It's not a perfect world. I mean, hopefully you're taking only one step back to go 2 steps forward. We had to do something. We couldn't leave the Bermuda in there and just till it under, because Bermuda will just, I mean, it'll eat you alive. Okay. And it worked out pretty good, because this is it later on in the season. We had, this is when the pole beans were just starting out. We tried corn, which I'll never grow corn in a small garden again. I forget what this was over here. I think that's just a summer cover. Oh, that's that summer cover crop. And then we had, eggplant and peppers. And we had other stuff all the way down the line. We had 10 beds of this. But you can see it worked out pretty good. We didn't take. And you know what? This cover crop here is building my topsoil again. I'm rebuilding my topsoil with that cover crop. Okay, so I'm addressing that. You know, I agree with you, but I had to get rid of the grass. That running grass was just, yeah. So you're right to point that out, but I mean, you know, running grass is too much. You got to get rid of some of it, you know. Okay, this is kind of like what you do on paper. So you want to do this on paper before you go out there and exert all this, you know, sweat equity. And really, you know, you lay out your bed, and on mine, if you can get 3 beds in, fine. What you do is you multiply. If you say, well, I got enough room to do 3 beds. So you multiply 3 times 6. 3 times, because you got 4 and 2, so that's 6. 3 times 6 minus 2, because you don't have a 2-foot out here. Okay? So 3 times 6 minus 2, if you got a 2-foot walkway, if you got a 26-inch walkway, you're going to have to do that. But that'll give you your width, and that's kind of a finite number. I mean, it can fluctuate, but it's got to be in multiples of 6 minus 2. Okay? Because you're doing 4, 2. Now the length, you know, this is just 10 feet here I'm using, but it could be any length you want, as long as it can be all equal. Okay? Any length you want, but you want 4-foot wide. Now for ladies who are doing this mostly by themselves, you might not want a 4-foot wide bed, because, you know, if you, now if you only got 10 feet of bed, you can walk around it. But if you got longer than that, you might want to step over it. And sometimes ladies, you know, have a, you know, unless you got real long legs, you can have a hard time stepping over 4 feet. I can sort of hop over a 4-foot wide bed, no problem, so I like it. I wouldn't go wider than that, though. I saw some guys try the 6-foot bed, and it was just, it was bad. Yeah, and you know, because you lose some efficiency. You know, you're going to waste some, your growing surface on walkways, and you want to get your beds as possible. And 3.5-foot beds are not that bad. I mean, and you lose a little efficiency, but not too much. And plus, you know, comfort in doing it and ease of doing it is part of the thing. You want to keep doing it. You don't want to be aggravated so bad by your wide beds that you don't even want to be out there. But anyways, everybody know how to survey your square off a square, because you really can't tell if you're square. I mean, you can get this length and this length and this the same, and you can get this width and this width the same, but you could end up with something like that, a parallelogram. Okay? And so what you do is, once you get these things staked temporarily, you don't drive them too deep because you might have to change them, you come in and you run your diagonals. I know some of you guys that build stuff do this all the time, laying foundations, but some of you guys might not, you know, might not know how to do this. And you want your diagonals to be equal. And if their diagonals are equal, then it's square. Okay? And you can use the, you know, you get kids to do this and teach them a little math and use your, what is that, Pythagorean's theorem. For right triangles, and you can tell what, you know this side, you know this side, you can tell what this should be, and that both of them should be equal to be square. Okay?
Why do you want your garden so square?
Okay, good question. The reason I want standardization and square is because I want my tiller, I don't want to have to go through narrow places with a tiller, or get slowly narrow because my walkway gets slowly narrower because I'm not square. When I weed my beds, I don't want to have to sit there and pick up my wheel hoe, my weeder, because I got a narrow or a thin part, you know. You're trying to, remember, you want speed. And if you lay it out right and you lay it out straight, when I'm weeding, because there's no big fluctuations, you know, I have nice straight lines and nice square beds, I can weed faster because I'm not having to adjust constantly to undulating beds and stuff like that. Okay. Yes, it's a little, you know, some people don't like the, you know, the orthodoxy of square beds, but, you know, they're more of a patchwork type of people. But I'm telling you, I'm just giving you what works. And all these, like I said, successful gardening is about doing a lot of little things. And a lot of little things add up to ease of gardening. Okay. It's not about, there's no magic bullet. Okay, that, oh yeah, you just do this and you're going to have, you know, like the mulch guy, you know, just put mulch on and all your problems will be solved. I don't believe in that. I think it's doing a lot of little things right. And this is just one little thing, this sort of squaring it off, you know, and not having thinning walkways or thinning beds because it's not square. Believe me, just trust me on that. I've had people not trust, you know, question that and, you know, not quite believe it, but they do it anyway, and 2 years later they're saying, I'm so glad you told me about that. Yeah. Okay, plan on paper the number of beds, so and the number of, the width of the walkways, metal stake the corners, square, and this is what I do when I do go in and do a bed for people. I plan it on paper, then I metal stake my far corners, because I'm not going to move those. Those are my landmarks. I'm going to, if I lose a wooden stake, I can always measure from the metal stakes, okay? And get back to where I need to be. Then I square it, the lengths even, the widths even, then to make sure the diagonals are even so it's square. I would stake the individual beds, you know, slanting it a little bit so the hose doesn't ride up when I drag it around. I string the beds, or I string at least one bed, because you can just do one bed, because you're only going to work on one bed at a time, and then you can just move the string to the next set of stakes. You know, you don't have to do string all these different strings. You can just do one bed at a time and have two lengths of string. It's better if you use some sort of braided line rather than some sort of twisted line because it doesn't fray as much. Anyway, the first time you till the bed, if it's just been hard grass, you look at your grass. If it's a runner grass, you're going to have to decide. If it's a non-running sort of clump type grass, you can till that right in. And your first till, go as deep as you want to go. There's not much life to destroy there anyway. So just go as deep as you want to go on your first till when you're making that bed initially. And then rake any soil that gets pushed outside the string line back in. And then you ditch the sides. Remember, ditch the sides about 6 inches and throw the stuff up into the middle of the bed. And then you, what I do, I call it cracking the sides. I go down the sides and I push the spade shovel down all the way and just crack it back and just sort of open up the sides. Okay? I only ditch it 6 inches, but then I go back and push it down all the way, the whole shaft of the blade of the shovel, and then just crack it and just go down and crack it like that. And that lets air down in there. You know, you get better penetration, better air penetration, better water penetration. It just sort of opens the soil up. And when you open the soil up, microbes move in. And you want the microbes moving because they're going to keep it open for you. Okay? So I crack the sides, go down in 12 inches, and then I go in and I crack the middle of the bed with either my spade fork, or if you want to invest in a big broad fork, which is just a big, more efficient spade fork is a big broad fork, I go in there and I'll crack the middle of the beds. Now you don't have to do a lot. You can overcrack the beds. I usually crack it here, I move back about 18 inches, maybe 2 feet, crack it again. If you get too jammed up, if you do crack here and move it back 6 inches and crack here, you think, well, I'm really, fracturing this soil. The bad thing is, if it's over-fractured, your hard pans will reform. You know, everybody know what I say when I mean when I say hard pan?
No.
You don't know what a hard pan is? It's like you can go down and it's soft for about 3 inches and then it's like hard. Now you can have rototilling can create hard pan. They call it plow pan then, because a rototiller's got that L tine. That L tine, and especially in clays, when that tine goes down, 8 inches or whatever it is, probably the maximum depth you're going to get out of a rototiller, it sort of slicks, and you get a big old hard pan 8 inches down. Well, that's not really good. You don't want to have any hard pan if you can help it. So that's another thing deep rototilling does, is it creates a plow pan. So if you broad fork it too close together, what happens is if your hard pan is too fractured, what will happen is it'll reform. But if you space those fractures up in the hard pan and then you plant something, the roots will get in there and keep it open. Yeah, you're going to ask a question?
This is very interesting. Is this on the paperwork that you have over there?
Some of it, not
this
all
right
of it.
Here? Not that? Okay.
No, I don't think that's
it's
on
a lot
there.
To write down,
Yeah, you got to write that down. But you can, I'm going to be here till Sunday, or I'm leaving Sunday. So anyway, then you crack the middle of it with a spade fork or a broad fork. You shallow till the bed again. Now you're shallow tilling, okay? Because you want to sort of smooth it out before you plant, right? Especially if you're direct seeding. Now if you're transplanting, you don't have to get it so smooth. But if you're direct seeding, people know what I'm saying when I say transplant direct seed. Because some things you direct seed, some things you plant from transplant. When you're transplanting, it doesn't have to be quite as smooth. But if you're direct seeding, you got to get it pretty fine so the soil can be on top of the seed and it'll germinate well. You don't want to have a lot of clods. So you kind of smooth it out again with a shallow till. Because remember, you've already done your one deep till you're allowed. You're not allowed a deep till after that. You shallow till it to kind of smooth it out and make the bed. I call it a finish till. Okay. And then that's going to push the soil out. So then you rake the soil back in inside the strings, and you take a rake, and I like to use a landscape rake, not a garden rake. A garden rake has real sharp, pointy fingers. I like to use a landscape rake. It has little dull, flat, asphalt rake, some people call them. I call them a landscape rake. They're usually wide, and they got made of aluminum, and they got the sort of the dull points, and they're a lot easier. You don't get hung up as much with them and stuff like that. And I reestablish that ditch and sort of bring the soil back in, and reestablish that ditch, which is easy to do because you already did it with your shovel. So you're just sort of taking loose dirt and putting it back in. And then I apply my fertilizers, whatever I'm going to be using for fertilizer. And in this case, and I rake the fertilizer in lightly and level the beds with the rake. Well, apply the fertilizer, and if you're doing a cover crop, I apply the cover crop at the same time, and then I level the beds in, level the beds good and with a rake, and that sort of incorporates my fertilizer and my cover crop seeds shallowly. Okay? Here it is again. Standardized permanent tilled beds, permanent grass walkways are efficient and doable for 3 acres or less, and every fall I come in and reseed, you know, reseed the peripheral with a clump grass. Fescue is what I use, and I reseed the walkways because they're not running grasses. You got to reseed, okay, or they're going to get bare on you as you walk on them and stuff like that. So these walkways are high traffic, and a lot of those clump grasses don't, you know, they wear out if you walk on them. So you got to keep reseeding them in the September. 10 minutes. Oh gosh. All right, if you're a bigger farmer, how can you do this? Well, you're with bigger farms, I was going to do the thing here. The problem with using a tractor is you're never going to get a permanent bed, permanent walkway. You can do it in the same place, and I would advise that, doing it in the same place every time. But you know, most tractors, we see the tire foot, this is the front, here's the steering wheel, and it's going this way, and here's the rear tires. Usually they're a little longer or a little wider, or a little more diameter to them. And usually the only thing you can buy for a tractor is a rototiller that covers the whole, you know, the whole side, covers the outside edge of the tires, right? So they don't make one where you can just form a bed and do this. And they don't make a rototiller that just fits on the inside of the tires. And you know, a 40 horsepower tractor is probably enough for a small farm, and you don't get 4 feet here. Usually you're lucky if you get 3.5. Usually it's shorter than that. So you're going to have narrower beds. But that's okay. You got a tractor, so you can do that. But still, you're running up against this problem of a rototiller that doesn't fit in that 3 feet. They always make them really big. So you end up having to till up everything every time. And then that way, the problem with that is you're going to have to reform your beds every time and your walkways. So that's why I like small tiller farms, you know, better than big where I have to buy a tractor. But you're sitting on a tractor, so it's less work than walking. So maybe there's some, you know, maybe that's better. I don't know. Some people don't think it's better. But what you can use to reestablish your walkways here, if you do have to do it this way, is you can use this, they call it a disc harrower. And you can, you know, this just, you know, you don't need two, or, you know, sometimes they put like five of them across and you kind of knife in some residue or something like that. Well, here you're just using it basically as a potato hiller. Sometimes they call them a potato hiller because you can hill up around potatoes on it. But this disc is canted in, and it's canted in here, and it just throws the dirt. It takes dirt on just inside the tire tracks and throws it up. Now that's lumpy, clumpy right there, right? So you just take your hand tiller, come down the top of it, and smooth it out, and you're done. You can plant. Okay, does that make sense? So that's what the bigger guys have to do when they have a, you know, big acreage and they have to do it that way. But they still do bed farming with walkways. They just have to reform their beds every time and reform their walkways every time, which to me is extra work. But you're sitting down, so it might not be that much extra work. I don't know. Here's a guy who had to, you know, he's got a big farm out in Arkansas. This is Mark Kane, and I've heard him speak. He goes to the Southern Sog, you know, these farming conferences. I haven't seen him at Acres, but I've seen him at Southern Sog. He's out in Arkansas. And you can see he did the big tractor thing, and now he probably had to run over this a bunch. The other thing with tractors, when you rototill with tractors, is you really, to form a bed afterwards, you really have to really get the dirt fluffy. You know, some people have a bed maker, and bed makers really don't work with under-tilled soil. They work better if you really get the dirt fluffy. So, you know what I just said about fluffy dirt? Well, that still holds, even if, you know, but you have to get fluffy dirt in order to make the bed. Here it looks like, the problem I don't like about this is it looks like he's having to over-till and get the dirt fluffy so he can go in and he's strung it, and now he's shoveling it to remake the beds and have a little bit of elevation to his beds. But he had to use a tractor, and now he's having to use his back to reshovel. I just like the grass walkways and the tiller better. I think it's a lot less work. And for 3 acres or less, you can do it that way. But I think he's got more than 3 acres. He's doing about 6 or 7. But anyway, just another way to do it. Here's Rachel at the Gaia Gardens when she took over. Again, she tilled the dirt. She had a tractor, so you can see there's no walkways or beds. She just tilled it up. She made the dirt nice and fluffy. She had to, so she could get this BCS tiller, and this is a rototiller with a furrower behind it. It's like a potato furrower. And she's just using that potato furrower to make her walkways. And she'll go over here and do it here, and she'll have a bed in the middle. So, again, to me, that was a lot of extra work. Even though she had a tractor, she still had to get out there and make her walkways. He saw the other guy. He still had to get out there and make his walkways. Why not just use a tiller on a permanent bed and a permanent walkway? So, anyway, this is a farm down in Florida I went to. When I go someplace, I mean, I'm not going to have time here, but I usually like to get online, go to localharvest.org, and find a local organic farm in the area and say, hey, can I come volunteer for half a day? And see how that guy's doing it. You know, and you can steal ideas and, you know, help the guy out. And usually they say, yeah, come on. Anyways, this guy's down in Florida. He had nice sandy soil. And you can see he's doing bed farming. And I'm telling you, he had a big wide. I put this in here because a lot of things. He had a big wide tractor, his widest tractor. And it was big, though. It was like 60 or 70 horsepower. It cost a lot, but he was being funded by somebody. I mean, he didn't, and he was able to afford it. And here they are, and this is a cultivator, and he's going down. I think he's got cabbage, and he's companion cropped arugula in between. So I didn't really want to get into that, but that's a good companion crop because it grows fast. Arugula grows really fast, so he can take that arugula out, and he can get two crops out of one bed. But also, here's his irrigation. And I like in-ground irrigation. I don't like these risers sticking up with this overhead sprinkling. I like in-ground, you know, like whole wellhead connection points, you know, like in-ground connection points. Because these things are always getting bumped by tractors and people, and you're always having to repair them. It's just a maintenance nightmare. Plus, I don't like overhead watering. I like to plug into a spigot and run drip lines. I like to drip irrigate. I don't like to sprinkle head over irrigate. I got a thing on irrigation, but the sprinkling overhead, it's more of a timing. You can't sprinkle late in the afternoon because you don't want the leaves wet at night. You got to do it early in the morning. You're having to drag hose around to set up the and I use tripod sprinklers so I can get up high above the plants, you know, and you're having to drag hoses around. On a hot day, you're losing about 50-60% of your water. Only about 40% is making it into the ground. So it's a lot more taxing on your water resources. Whereas drip, you can drip because you're not getting the leaves wet. You can drip at night. You can put it on a timer, turn it on, go to bed. It'll turn off automatically. You get up and all your crops are watered right when they need to be in the dead of night when they take up water, getting ready for the daytime. Most plants take up water like 2 hours before dawn and maybe 2 hours after. And they take up water then. And they don't take 3 minutes. Yikes. Okay, this is Gaia Gardens from the top end. And this is a big farm, acre and a half. And you can see, real quick, they have, this is a plot here. That's 5,000 square feet. This is 5,000 square feet right next to each other. And these are fields. These are rotational fields. Now, he can get like 10 beds in that field. And 5,000 square feet is a good maximum rotational size because 5,000 square, and over here he's got longer fields, but they're narrower. They're still 5,000 square feet. So he's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and a little bit of 10 is over here. He's got 11 and 12 over here. So he's got 12 5,000 square foot beds, and that's what he rotates his crop rotation around. They're all 5,000, so they're standardized. So he's doing the same thing every year. He rotates. And why 5,000 is the max? Because when you're small farming, 5,000 is about what one man can do in one day. If you're harvesting, you can harvest, you know, in about 6 hours, 5,000 square feet. If you're tilling, you can till. If you're weeding, you can weed. One man can do 5,000. And it's a lot better because you can say, well, I can do that. But if you get out there and you got an acre and a half that needs weeding and you don't have any, you know, partitions, you get demoralized and you want to walk away. And like, oh, I'll never get this done, you know. But 5,000 is something that's a doable amount, okay? And here it is drawn out. I kind of had to turn it to get it in. We'll go through this real quick. But, you know, 5,000, 5,000, 5,000, 5,000. And I think there was 10 100-foot beds in here. So we got 20 50-foot beds. There were 10 100-foot beds, but we marked those down into 20. And when we planned our crop, we just said, okay, we're going to put, you know, 10-foot a bed of this, and or 50-foot a bed of this, and 50-foot a bed of that, and we had 20 to do up. So we could do varieties, and it was really easy that way. And here it is kind of mapped out. You know, I did field number one, which is here. up there. You can see this is the number of beds. And then here's field number 7, which is here, which is a little shorter. So I had 7 beds here. I had 5 beds here. But here I had 21 beds. Here I had 20. Close enough. Okay, so you had about 20 beds each. And we'll fly through that. Okay, this is a good sort of worm's view of the beds. You can see here's my vertical ditch. When I say ditch it, I got a little elevation here above my walkway. And this is a mowing width. And, you know, my tractor tires, if I'm doing a tractor, my tractor tires are out here. And I want to make sure, I still want to, you know, be able to do a lawnmower down there. So what I do is when I do the next bed, I'll come out 2 tractor widths instead of just one. A lot of guys want to, you know, just do one tractor width. Well, that's really narrow and you're going to have to weed that or you're going to have weeds grow up in it. So I like to make sure I can get a mower down here, even when I use a tractor. And I just sort of space it out, the beds out a little further than I have to. Then when you space your plants, this represents beds and these are like plant canopies. Here's people that want to do a little bit of everything in a bed, and this is a no-no because you're going to get sunlight gaps. You're going to get things growing faster than other things, and they're going to shade out, and other things aren't going to grow. You want to grow the same thing in a 10-foot bed, and when you do that, you don't want to line them up like this because you get a big old hole in the middle, even with a full canopy, and that's where sunlight can get through, and you have weeds. You want to plant like this, sort of staggered, and you can see there's a lot less sunlight getting through there. And that's what you're spacing. How do you manage weeds? By spacing it not too tight where it limits growth, but tight enough so it manages the weeds for you. The canopy manages the weeds for you. Okay? There's my romaine lettuce. There's my mother looking at it, and she's really impressed. Because that was a really good year. You should be able to grow romaine lettuce like this every time. But we had really nice looking romaine lettuce. And it's done just the way that picture was. So it's not just something that you can diagram out. I mean, you can actually do it this way, okay? You can make a lot of money on a bed of lettuce. I didn't think there was a lot of money in lettuce, but after tomatoes, it's probably the second biggest money crop there is lettuce. And those romaines sold really, I was charging $2 a head for that. And I couldn't keep them. I was thinking about going up because they were just moving too fast. But here, this is on one of my spreadsheets, and it's just a piece of my spreadsheet. But you can see, if I do 2 rows of something on a 4-foot wide bed, theoretically, if I had a 6-inch curb, I could put them 36 inches apart. But when I do 2 rows of something, I like to make my curbs a little wider, and I do them 24 inches apart. When I do 3 rows, theoretically, if I had a 6-inch curb, I could do them 18 inches apart, but I like to give myself a 9-inch curb, and I just do it 15 inches apart. But you add that up together, the 9, the 15, and the 3 rows, and it all is going to come out to 48. Okay? And this is just a quick reference for me. So I say, well, I want to put 4 rows of something in. I can just say, well, I have to plant those 12 inches apart, you know, rows apart, and I need a 6-inch curb. The curb is from that knife edge along the side to my first row. That's the curb. Okay, and then I go between plants. That's the other. So everybody know what a curb is? When I say curb, the first row of plant and that edge of your bed. Okay. Then if you have slopes, you're going to have to get. If you have a 6% slope, you're going to have to do contour farming. 6 to 12% slope, you're going to have to do contour farming. How do you know if you have a 6 to 12% slope? You get one of those 3-foot levels and you stick it out there and you make it level. And if you measure the distance between the end of the level and the bottom of the ground, and if it's 6% more than the length, or you know, if it's 6% of the length, then you got a 6% slope. Anything that measures 6 or 12%, you're probably going to have to do contour farming. Forget everything I just said, and you're going to have to follow the contour of the slope. And then if you have a 12% or more slope, you probably have to go into terrace farming, like this guy did, which I wouldn't even do it. I might do it, but you know, this is a lot of work. So, just try to look for level land. I've done it. I've actually went up to Washington and tried to do terracing on a mountain. Oh, it was a killer. Okay. Considerations when you're making your beds: sunshine needs. Where am I going to put these beds? Morning sun is crucial. Okay. So. A lot of things, you know, you want to get that dew burned off fast. So you don't want any trees to the east. If you're gonna if you have to put them up against the trees, number one, a lot of squirrels like trees, and a lot of things that eat your fruit like to hide in trees. So try to keep it as far away as the trees as you can for the animal rodent reasons. And the number two is, especially on the east side, keep the trees backed off so you can get some morning sun and get that dew off. Cucumbers hate to have dew left on their leaves, and they get all kinds of funguses if they have too much dew left too long. So fruit and seed crops, anything that produces a fruit, like a tomato or a squash or a cucumber, they need 8 hours. It takes a lot of energy. You need a lot of sun to produce that fruit. Grass crops, flower crops, stalk crops, stalk crops to flower and grass, they need about 7 to 8. Root crops need 6 to 7 hours, and leaf crops need 5 to 6. So look at your shadows. Put your beds where the sun is, okay? And just realize that. And if you have to have trees, make sure the trees are to the west, not to the east. So it's better to have a little shade maybe in the hot afternoon than it is in the morning where you can't dry off the dew, okay? And if you've got to have trees, it's better to have trees to the north, blocking cold winds that come in from the north, than to have them to the south, where as it gets later in the year, your sun's going to arc lower and you're going to have shadows from trees to the south, because your sun's going to be going south on its arc. Bottom land collects nutrients. We all know that. So it's harder to farm. You have nutrient-rich soil on a slope because some of the stuff's going to drain down. But the bottom land collects it. But bottom land better have some good drainage, because if it doesn't drain well, you're going to have problems. Wind blocks are usually good, especially wind blocks to where the wind comes from, like to the west. And I mean wind block, I mean like a hedgerow. Like you could plant blueberries or your orchard trees to the west if the wind comes from the west, or to the north if the wind comes from the north. So wind blocks are usually good things. A lot of things have microclimates, so even though you have the local weather, that's measured at an airport. You're 10 miles away from the local airport, so you might have a hotter place. You know that L-shaped bed in that last picture? In that corner, the sun sort of beats down in that corner, and it's about 10 degrees hotter over there than in those other beds. So you get these little microclimates. Some areas collect water than other areas. So realize where your microclimates might be. Soil texture, of course, can be different in different parts of your farm. And then you want to use the right crop varieties and grow what grows best. Don't try to grow the most hardest thing or the most weirdest thing. Find out the variety. Talk to other farmers. Find out what grows good in your area and grow that and have a success. And then you won't get frustrated. Okay, this is the last thing I think. You want to run your beds east to west if possible. Why is that? Because right up there. That's kind of the second reason, but we'll go over it. Your magnetic flux lines run under the earth, and if they're parallel, if your beds are north-south, they're parallel to the magnetic flux lines, and your plant, it feeds off energy, it grows off energy, and magnetic flux lines are energy. It's not hocus-pocus, it's the same thing, reason a compass works, there's because of the magnetic flux lines under the earth, and so... You want to run perpendicular to those east-west, and you get a little bit of extra energy out of that, and it helps your crops a little bit. The other really big reason is you get less shadow effect if you run them east and west, because if you run your beds north and south, and you have a tall crop like pole beans here, and you have a short crop like, bush beans over here, then it's going to be noon before the bush beans get any, if this is the east, it's going to be noon before the bush beans get any sun, because the tall crops shadowing them out. But if you run them east-west, or if it gets afternoon, then this gets shadowed out by your tall crop over here. If it runs east and west, then you don't get that shadow effect. It just, everything gets the same amount of sun, and you get very little shadow effect. I mean, you're a little further north than I am, but I'm sure it would work out just fine here. So, anyways, I didn't get to my next one, but I guess that's it.